Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI says religion should promote peace and fight racism and totalitarianism. An interreligious conference in Poland sees the participation of some 500 key religious figures gathered in a common prayer for peace. And Benedictine abbot Timothy Wright continues in his talks on the four books of Jonah. Pope Benedict XVI marked the 70th anniversary of the start of World War II on Sunday, saying religion should promote peace and fight racism and totalitarianism. Speaking during his traditional Sunday blessing while visiting the city of Viterbo, just north of Rome, the Pope said the memory of one of the worst conflicts in history should serve as a warning to never repeat such a barbarity as the Holocaust and the extermination of millions of innocents. Emma McCarthy has this report.
Pope Benedict XVI returned to the role of religions in promoting forgiveness and reconciliation against the violence of war and extremism Sunday in a message delivered from the medieval city of Viterbo, Italy. The Pope had travelled there early Sunday morning to celebrate Mass with the faithful of the diocese and visit the historical and spiritual sites of the place known as the City of the Popes. In a message following the Angelus prayer, Pope Benedict greeted religious leaders who are in Krakow, Poland, to attend the St. Egidio meeting of faiths and cultures in dialogue, which this year marks the 70th anniversary of the outbreak of World War II.
Non possiamo non ricordare i drammatici fatti.
The Pope said, "We cannot forget one of the most terrible wars in history, which caused tens of millions of deaths, the tragedy of the Holocaust, and the extermination of scores of other innocent people." He said, "The memory of these events lead us to pray for the victims and for those who still bear wounds in body and heart, and it is also a warning to everyone not to repeat such barbarism and to intensify efforts to build a lasting peace in our time."
Si è inoltre monito per tutti a non ripetere tali barbarie.
Pope Benedict concluded that the contribution that religions can and should play in promoting forgiveness and reconciliation against violence, racism, totalitarianism and extremism is particularly important because they disfigure the image of the Creator of man, they wipe the horizon of God, and consequently lead to contempt of man himself. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Thanks there to Emma McCarthy for that report. And later in the day, on Sunday afternoon, Pope Benedict travelled from Viterbo to nearby Bagnoregio. This tiny town is in fact the birthplace of Saint Bonaventure, a 13th century Franciscan theologian who became Minister General of his order and Cardinal Bishop. Pope Benedict celebrated him as a messenger of hope, a model of the Christian intellectual, and an inspiration to all those who in the present day would work to raise appreciation of and guarantee respect for God's creation. Chris Altieri reports.
One of the giants of medieval thought, St. Bonaventure was declared a doctor of the Church in 1588, just 100 years after his canonization. The saint and doctor was also one of the principal intellectual influences on the man who would become Pope Benedict XVI.
Nel ricordo di questo profondo ricercatore ed amante della sapienza, vorrei inoltre esprimere incoraggiamento.
In remarks to civic and religious leaders and the whole people of Bagnoregio on Sunday afternoon, the Holy Father said one of the principal lessons that Bonaventure has for us is that faith is the perfection of our powers of understanding and participation in the knowledge that God has of himself and of the world. Pope Benedict also described St. Bonaventure as a messenger of hope, which we experience as a preparation for our encounter with the Lord, an encounter that shall sign the fulfillment of the friendship that even now binds us to him. Pope Benedict went on to say, Bonaventure also tells us that charity introduces us to the divine life, bringing us to see all men as brothers according to the will of our common celestial Father. A Franciscan through and through, St. Bonaventure also had a deep love of creation, God's loving gift to humanity, in all and every part of which St. Bonaventure found a reflection of God's matchless beauty and goodness.
Quanto sarebbe utile che anche oggi si riscoprisse la bellezza e il valore del creato alla luce della bontà e della bellezza divine.
How useful it would be, said Pope Benedict, if people in our own day could rediscover the beauty and goodness of creation in light of the beauty and goodness of God. I'm Chris Altieri.
Thanks there to Chris Altieri for that report. Yes, as Chris was saying, Saint Bonaventure, who was born in Bagnoregio, represents one of the two major intellectual influences on Pope Benedict's entire theological formation, together with Saint Augustine. What's more, in Germany, scholars must write two dissertations. The first is to receive a doctoral degree. The second is to qualify for a professional post. And the young Joseph Ratzinger, in the mid-1950s, wrote this second post-doctoral thesis on St. Bonaventure and on his understanding of history.
For understanding the reason of this trip, we have to go and to look into the Pope's own past.
Father Lorenzo Turchi studies medieval theology at the Pontifical Antonianum University.
Because in 1953, Ratzinger was studying and he passed the final examination for his doctorate. And then he chose San Bonaventure for teaching. I think that it's important for us because Ratzinger discovered that the revelation of God, it's a great mystery and needs someone who can perceive it. So we can say that God needs us because we can hear his voice.
I asked Father Lorenzo to tell me something more about Saint Bonaventure himself.
He studied in the famous University of Paris, where he taught with St. Thomas d'Aquinas, the angelic daughter. But we can say that Bonaventure is the seraphic daughter, because in his study we can find the love for God. And I think that St. Bonaventure understood that in order to be a true disciple of God, he wanted to meet him with his mind and his heart. So it's a great meaning for us today, because it's important to study and to meet God with mind and heart together.
In his message Sunday, in which he commemorated the outbreak of World War II 70 years ago and spoke of the role of religions in promoting forgiveness and reconciliation, Pope Benedict sent his best wishes to participants of an ongoing international congress in Krakow, Poland. The congress, organized by the Archdiocese of Krakow and the community of Sant'Egidio, sees the participation of some 500 key religious figures gathered in a common prayer for peace. The meeting, entitled The Spirit of Assisi in Krakow, aims to launch yearly interreligious supplications to make the earth a peaceful place for all. And you may remember, similar events took place every year in Assisi during the lifetime of Pope John Paul II. My Italian colleague Stefano Leccinski is in Krakow following the Congress. He caught up with Rabbi David Rosen, director of the American Jewish Committee's Department for Interreligious Affairs. He pointed out that the theme of the Congress is dialogue to improve and reach reconciliation among people, and began by asking Rabbi Rosen, how can this work?
Well, every journey begins with a step. And the community of Sant'Egidio is really very much a pioneer in this field of engaging the religious communities, especially what you might call the hardcore communities. In the past, interreligious dialogue has generally been an engagement of the liberal fringes. This does not make it in any way less important, but it has not really impacted upon the more traditional segments of the community. And this has been part of the brilliance of the approach of the community of Sant'Egidio, to be able to reach out and overcome the suspicions and fears, mainly historical fears, within different communities so that they can be more profoundly engaged in these relationships. If we take the historic initiative of John Paul II in Assisi in 1986, at that meeting there was no representative of the chief rabbinate of Israel. And it was only with John Paul II who initiated the first formal dialogue between the chief rabbinate of Israel and the Holy See. But that in many respects came about because the community of Sant'Egidio took up this initiative after 1986 and started initiating these contacts to bring the different communities together. As a result, if I talk now within my colleagues within the Orthodox rabbinate, there is more understanding of the Christian world today, more desire for engagement, not only with Christian world but with other communities, more involvement in interreligious dialogue than ever before. And this therefore changes perceptions. It overcomes prejudices, it overcomes bigotry, it opens up new opportunities, and therefore religions as a result can play a more constructive role in not only influencing their societies, but in supporting political initiatives to be more successful. In my opinion, one of the reasons for the failure of peace initiatives in my part of the world, in Jerusalem and in the Holy Land, has been a failure to engage religion. I understand why politicians have avoided religious institutions. When you see terrible things that are done in the name of religion, then you think that the right thing to do is to avoid it. But that is a fallacy. All aspects of nature abhor a vacuum. If you don't want religion to be part of the problem, you have to make it part of the solution. It has to be engaged in the positive processes. Religion needs to support positive political initiatives. And through interreligious dialogue, we bring the religious voices more into the public square of engagement on these issues.
How it is possible to improve the dialogue among religious leaders and political leaders? Because you were saying that the mistake was that the political part did not involve enough the religious leaders and the religious communities. But often it seems that there is absolutely no dialogue between the political part and the religious part.
Exactly.
So which way and which method could be assumed?
Well, I think you have touched upon a really critical question. And if I knew the complete answer to that, I would be very, very happy. All I know is that we have to make every effort to try to ensure that there is more engagement between political leadership and religious leadership. And there are ways in which we are trying to do that. Specifically in the Middle East at the moment, we have formed a council of the religious institutions of the Holy Land that involves Muslim leaders of Palestinian society, the patriarchs, the bishops, and the chief rabbinate of Israel. And we have tried to organize meetings with political leadership in order to emphasize and make it clear to them how important it is to engage these religious leaders. Religion is not the same thing in every part of the world. Religious leadership does not have the same role in every part of the world. In some places, it really is the leading force. Other places, it's, if you like, an underlying social force. And in our part of the world, in the Middle East, especially Muslim and Jewish leadership is to some degree subject to political authority. But the fact that it does not provide prophetic leadership does not mean that it is insignificant, because it still represents the core identities of the peoples involved, and therefore it's necessary to engage it. And this is very difficult for secular politicians to understand. Most secular politicians are suspicious of religion, if not hostile to religion, and therefore we have to work hard to overcome their prejudices, as well as the capacity of the religious leadership to understand that they need to be engaged. This is a process, and we have to keep working at it. Unfortunately, those like myself who are working on this process are pioneers, and this is a new development which some politicians grasp. I would actually say Well, in some parts of the world, this is an understanding that comes more naturally. But in many parts of the world, it's very difficult to get this message across. And we just have to be determined to work at it harder and harder.
Talking about one of the themes of the meeting, the beginning of the World War II, and its main symbol here in Poland, which is Auschwitz. Auschwitz is still a place where, of course, it is a symbol of horrible genocide and Holocaust of Jewish people, but it's still a place which can divide. Why it is like that?
Well, allow me, before I address this very important question, to also point to the fact that to be here in Krakow, in Poland, 70 years after the Second World War, is itself a manifestation of triumph, of hope over destruction. And that's very much personified in the person of the late John Paul II. And nations that were enemies and were totally filled with hate for one another now cooperate, and even there is warmth between them, and you have now such a totally new spirit. So just being here at this particular moment in time is a testimony to the triumph of hope over destruction. Now, with regards to Auschwitz specifically, all memories, as almost all aspects of life, have their positive and negative potential. The Bible, Pentateuch, the Torah, emphasizes the importance of memory. We are always told, remember, you were a stranger, you were a slave, you suffered in Egypt. Why are we meant to remember it? Because the Torah, the Bible, says, so that you will be sensitive towards other strangers, towards other marginalized people, and that you will therefore develop a positive moral lesson from it. According to Jewish tradition, over 36 times we are reminded that we were strangers in the land of Egypt and to be sensitive to others. Why so many times? The Talmud says, because there is the danger that you may use your history to be insensitive instead of to be sensitive. People can go through a traumatic experience and say, I've been such terrible trauma, why should I care for somebody else? Nobody cared about me. Or I am still wounded and I'm still hurting and still nobody cares about me. They still hate me, therefore I turn my back on them because they turn their back on me. So any experience can have its positive and its negative dimensions. And when people are wounded and they are in pain, and pain can last a very long time, when they can be victims of trauma. So the challenge is how to ensure that memory does not imprison you, but memory inspires you, motivates you to be more expansive, more compassionate, more engaging. So this is a perennial challenge. It's not just in Auschwitz. It's in every experience of pain and of suffering. But because Auschwitz embodies, as you said, the ultimate suffering, but unparalleled, arguably, in the whole of human history, so the capacity both to imprison and to inspire is greater perhaps than anywhere else. And it's really important for our communities, for the Jewish community, to see our leaders engaged with other religions and with other communities at Auschwitz to emphasize that here, yes, there are particular lessons, but there are above all universal lessons that we must bring to as guidance for humanity at large.
You've been listening to Rabbi David Rosen, Director of the American Jewish Committee's Department for Interreligious Affairs. The English program will be broadcasting the second part of that interview during upcoming programs. And now my friend, Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright, continues in his talks on the Book of Jonah. This is talk two, and follows on from where Jonah had offered his life to God in atonement to his sin of disobedience. But it was also to show the sailors on the floundering boat that their gods were false and his god was true, a fact that was shown because the sea calmed down and they could continue their journey in safety.
Jonah is now falling through the sea, bound up. But he wasn't falling to the bottom of the sea. He wasn't drowning. Because what happened was, the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights. Now, perhaps fish is a little too organized as a description of the what some call the great sea monster, the great Leviathan of the Eastern tradition. Because the picture of Leviathan is of the chaos, the opposite of order of creation. And Jonah was positioned inside the belly of the fish, as they say, wasn't a way of being devoured and eaten, but rather was a way of talking about exile or banishment. It's a way of talking about going into another world, the world of the other. It means a world separated from God, separated from family and relationships, separated from memory of the past. So it is a descent into a void, an exile, a catastrophe. The family know nothing, presumed dead. God knows nothing except that Jonah is with the other. And Jonah is aware that he is alone. And he's there in the belly of that fish for 3 days. And during that time, he prays. He's been put in a position where he has got nothing else to do. He's on his own, nothing to relate with. And he therefore discovers in the depth of his being the only resource that can give him any hope, which is God. He's trapped in a place he cannot get out of, a place which has none of the usual elements to make up an ordinary human life. The only resource he has is faith in God and faith as expressed through prayer. I called to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me out of the belly of the shale. I cried, and you heard my voice. Reminiscent of the Psalms, of one who has been alienated, has been cast off, isolated. You cast me into the depth, into the heart of the seas, and the flood surrounded me. All your waves and your billows passed over me. Punishment deserved, yes. The world of the other, the opposite in one sense of God's creating act, but in another sense, God's way of saying, go and be apart from me. Learn to go to those places which are not comfortable, which don't suit, where there are no relations of love, of tenderness, of affirmation and encouragement. I am cast out from before your eyes, and I will never see your holy temple again. Jonah's sense that he is doomed to stay in this place of exile forever. And we can well understand it. His faith produces the words. The words produce a plea. The plea, Jonah is never sure that it is heard. It is locked in an inner prison, and many of us perhaps can relate to that experience. The experience of feeling unloved, unwanted, of feeling excluded, of feeling inadequate, either because of illness, or because of sin, or because of failure, or because of abuse, or because, for one reason or another, we found ourselves in this exile, inner exile of loneliness, inner exile abandoned for a moment, at least, by those whom we love and who love us. An exile caused by a failure of love, a failure of understanding, a failure to appreciate, or perhaps even a sense of shame, to which members of our family have said, go into exile. And so we can relate to Jonah when he says, the waters round me rose to my neck, the deep was closing round me, seaweed twining around my head. I went to the very bottoms of the mountains, the gates of the nether world barred me in forever. Yes, at the depth of this exile, each of us at moments can relate. As we can relate with the Jonah experience I talked about in the first, of rebellion and rejection. Now, in the punishment, if you like, the exile caused by that disobedience, I find myself alienated. But it doesn't have to be always a disobedience. It can be others who have pushed me there. As my life was ebbing away, said Jonah, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to you into your holy temple. Yes, I am not tempted to follow other gods, although I may have tried to do so. I realize that it is only you, Lord, who can save me. I cannot get out of this prison myself. I cannot be freed from exile. I cannot be taken out of the victim status of feeling abused, of feeling misused, of feeling ill-treated, of feeling exploited, because I locked. You alone can help me. And so, Lord, says Jonah, if you can save me, I will offer sacrifice to you. And what I have vowed, I will pay, because it's only to you, Lord, that my deliverance is possible. And it is in that deliverance that I will discover my true self again, discover what love is, discover what relationships is. Be thankful for the gifts I receive. Be aware of the gifts I can give. Be there to show love to those in greatest need. And the chapter ends, the Lord spoke to the fish, and it spewed Jonah out upon the dry land. Amen.
That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.